starting all these boots, put them on, we're gonna go get extreme.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Narstool Podcast.
Welcome to the Narstool Podcast. I'm Shannon O'Grady, your science nerd and research ranger. We've got JMO here, Jason Morgan, human performance nerd, similar nerd, yet somewhat different. Bike enthusiast and aspiring ski bum. JMO, Father's Day. How was it?
It was awesome. First biological Father's Day.
Yeah.
I've been a stepdad for like 6 years, which is the coolest thing ever.
For sure.
But being a biological dad with a little dude was, it was fun.
What'd you guys do?
You know, true to form, Liam got up early. We were up at 5:30. So we got up and did some dude time.
Dude time or duty time?
Both. Yep. All the above. So yeah, some quality duty time to start the day and then had a little nap. His morning nap, and then we wound up going to brunch, which was super fun. Got to watch the Yankee Red Sox game, which sucked because I'm a Yankee fan. They got their asses kicked. Mm-hmm. Got a little bike ride in, and then some pool time. So
nice,
all in with the kiddos, and Katie and I snuck out for a bike ride. So it was cool. It was a really nice all around day of spending time with the kiddos and my wife, and got to, you know, do all the fun stuff that I like to do.
Good.
So, yeah, it was a win. It was a good time, and to all the dads out there or dad figures, like I hope everyone had a good day because it was fun to just relax and do some stuff with the kiddos.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah, we had a good weekend too. A little pool time, some yummy food cooked. Yeah.
Backflip attempts.
Good family time. Yeah. Do not attempt to do a backflip when challenged by your 10-year-old in 4 feet of water. Hit my head on the bottom of the pool pretty hard. I'm an idiot. But anyways.
Hey, you know, we'll talk about good decision-making at another time. I am really psyched to introduce this week's guest, Desiree Melanson, professional snowboarder, grad student, artist, mental health advocate, founder of an incredible nonprofit called Stay, Somebody's Thinking About You, and way, way more. Desiree, welcome to the Narstool.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have you, Desiree. I have really enjoyed learning about you and learning about Stay. I hadn't heard of the organization until we got acceptance to have you on the podcast and started reading about it. And I think mental health advocacy is so important, but the add-on of it being in action sports and the importance of bringing awareness to that field in particular, I think is critical. Can you talk a little bit about how that started for you? And I guess the first seeds of the idea?
Yeah. The nonprofit, I mean, it's cool. I'm really proud of it. I think we've come a long way. We're about to turn 4 in August. So the original intention of creating it was that there was simply just like a lack of places that were having the conversations about mental health and about suicide. So a couple years back, lost some really dear friends to suicide. And then there was the reality of I had attempted 10 years ago. So like once kind of like the communal grief started occurring when suicide occurred, like as suicides were happening in my mind, I was like, oh, my name should have been the top one, like the first one at that list within our friend group in a way. And I just really struggled with it to where I hadn't told anybody, I hadn't gone public. And then when, you know, the grief was happening, I was just like, I wish that they would have known. I wish that they would have known that like there is life after suicide if you survive it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, you know, the sad like realities of like, usually when men attempt, they use more lethal means. It's harder to survive. I used a softer means. So it was like just really weird. And I was really angry. And then I'm also like kind of solution focused where I'm like, okay, cool. What can there be? So I realized like once I started talking about it, people were also sharing their stories. And also I think I sensed a lot of relief in some of my peers where they're like, oh my God, like I want to die too. And kind of just like formulated this plan to normalize the conversation, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I love the acronym Somebody's Thinking About You because it seems like the idea of being alone and isolated is such a big part of that desire to end your life. And you from the folks that I've encountered that have attempted, that's always part of the conversation. And so it very succinctly addresses that in the name. How did that name come to fruition?
Oh my gosh. I think it was about a month of ideating. And so I have two undergrad degrees, one in art, the other in social science. Didn't really know how to start a nonprofit, but 23 years of experience in marketing because of professional snowboarding. I'm like, cool, you need a good name. You need a good logo. You need good branding. So I'm super fortunate to have that experience. So like, as I was starting the nonprofit, I'm like, all right, cool. I just need this thing to make sense. And I was also obsessed with like the concept of an acronym. I think they're fun. I think sometimes they're annoying, but you know, like referencing DARE or POW, like just kind of wanting something catchy to be able to make it easily shareable. So literally had this like 5-foot by 8-foot whiteboard in my living room in Portland. And at the time I was living with Jill Perkins and Katie Kennedy. And I think like just nonstop, like acronym and names, just like nothing's making sense. And one night I was up pretty late to like 2:30 in the morning and Jill came home pretty late and she was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I got to name this thing. And so like, I remember she like sat down with me and kind of helped me. And I'm like, I think stay is good because like, you don't want people to kill themselves. So it's like, what is it? And then Jill and I kind of just like went back and forth and like, it was just like, somebody's like, thinking. And then it was just like, cool, somebody's thinking about you. And literally her and I were just like, oh my God, that's it. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
And then got super lucky, like doing the database search. And there's a couple things like that are called Stay, but they're like for-profit companies. And then, yeah, we just kind of lucked out with it working with the nonprofit.
Yeah. And you guys do a lot of education. Can you kind of talk our audience through how Stay, I guess, what outreach for Stay looks like?
Like, what do you mean outreach? Like what we do?
What you do, how you try to educate about mental health, how you maybe help people that are in crisis?
Yeah, sure. We don't help people in crisis. Okay. That's the one thing we don't do. All right. Or we don't do a lot of things, but we are not a crisis hotline. Mm-hmm. If you are in crisis, please call or text 988 or walk yourself into your local ER. For the most part, Stay is like multifaceted, where the first thing we do is we combat the stigma. How do we combat the stigma? We normalize the conversation. We create merch that's easily wearable because we partner with incredible artists and, we've made it look cool. It looks, you know, people are in a way like proud to wear the merchandise. And, I think that's what's really made us stand apart from most nonprofits. You know, sometimes it's just like one color and a pretty simple logo. Like for us, like we really invested in the way the message would be shared, you know, and like the name alone is a really easy way to talk about suicide prevention, where it's like, hey, Stay, somebody's thinking about you. I am thinking about you. And to go back to your point earlier, yeah, like suicidality is just like, the classic message is like, you're not alone, you know? So we even had to evolve on that because I can't just make a nonprofit and take a slogan that's already existed. Like it's, we had to embody the you're not alone and you're not a burden and we love you. Please stay. So from that, like, yeah, we combat the stigma, normalize the conversation. And then, over the last 3 years, I don't know what to call her. She's like, I started calling her like my co-founder or like co-executive director. But Monica Mason is a licensed social worker in Salt Lake City. Once she came on board, we really were able to focus on what our like services could look like. And she has a ton of experience working with the houseless population in Salt Lake. She did the most recent road home, like really incredible work. Plus she has her own private practice. In a way she's my mentor, especially as I'm becoming a therapist, also my best friend. But so we've been able to build out a team of mental health professionals who all attend our events. So like for a while we were trying to do like free group therapy. Turns out people are scared of group therapy. You know, we were doing mental health awareness talks, and sometimes we had engagement, sometimes we didn't. The thing that really started to work was like our custom suicide prevention trainings. And so we did a bunch of research and like composed this pretty digestible training that kind of got rid of clinical language and made it so that the community can actually have like a guidebook, like a plan for what to do in order to help yourself or a loved one. So that's like one of the bigger things that we do. In addition to that, now we host like art nights to try to just like get people in spaces together where they can safely talk about mental health issues. And pretty much at every event, I have a mental health professional there in case anything comes up. If somebody's just curious about how do I find a therapist? I'm really struggling. Like we provide this like protective factor so that people can just like have access without needing to make a doctor's appointment or without needing to have insurance. In about 2 weeks, we're launching a national grief support line. So we've built out like an additional team of mental health professionals who all specialize in grief work. We've had a lot of loss in our community this year. The snowboard community is really hurting. And, you know, people kind of reached out to the nonprofit and were like, what do we do? What's protocol here? I kind of just need somebody to talk to. So we designed this program. One of our board members, Jessica Decker, who's a CMHC, did this really cool, like 3 to 5 session grief workshop, basically. People just have to send an email and then you get aligned with a professional. It's fully confidential. It's not therapy. But at the end of the program, you'll have like a plan for like your recommended level of care. And if you do want to continue with therapy, like where you can find it and where you can go.
That's amazing. So looking at both the people in the community experiencing loss, also equipping them with, tools or the right words to use in trying to help someone, whether it's themselves or someone that they know and love, hopefully not take that suicidal step. And then providing people that are considering suicide, the community potentially to help them through that, I guess, I don't know what the right word to use, but through that part of their lives. Can you talk a little bit, you mentioned the art night, but what other types of events do you guys do to build that community?
It's like the crafting nights, it's a different craft every time. So we were just kind of like candle making or crocheting or like bracelet making. Another thing we've been doing is we table at events. So like at the events, we're just there with merch and a mental health professional, and like people just come up and talk to us and kind of like give them the educational materials there. So that in a way is even community building, because at these like action sport events, there's us where it's like, oh, hey, maybe you're struggling with your mental health and you're supposed to be stoked right now, but you can come to our booth and like go on a walk and talk with one of our therapists and kind of just like have that support structure. I think that's pretty unique. Other than that, we did like at Woodward Park City, we did a community ride day where we invited like people in the community to come up, snowboard with us. Had a couple professional athletes there, Bino, who's a skier who's deaf and a mental health advocate. And then Jill Perkins came. She's also a mental health advocate and super big time pro. And so the people who attended just basically got to like lap with people who were like, yeah, we're going to talk about mental health. We did like a Gosney pizza cookout at the resort and then had a panel discussion where a therapist just kind of asked me, Jill and Bino, questions about our experiences with mental health issues. And so like people having access to that even once again builds community where the people who were there kind of like met each other and all of a sudden they're friends. And then we have like new volunteers and employees from it even. So in a way, like the nonprofit serves as this space for people to like come into.
What's the age range of folks that you guys work with?
As far as staff or as far as people who engage with us?
People that would love to engage with you, yeah.
I mean, we go anywhere from 12 to 75.
That's awesome.
I've had so many different conversations with all types of people. And, you know, the reality is there's not, depending on how old you are, everyone on this planet will eventually be touched by a mental health issue and potentially suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious, going back to kind of the inspiration to start Stay, you talked about, you know, 10 years ago you had attempted and kind of your journey with mental health. Can you talk us through how you got through that and got out of it? Obviously, it's such a complex issue. There's so many layers to it. Can you take our audience through some of the things that helped you pull yourself up?
I think back and it still makes perfect sense how I ended up there. I think professional athletics is a pretty tough industry to exist in, especially when you're a marginalized person. My lived experience is quite unique. So when it happened, you know, it's funny because in a way the research kind of says like two contradicting things, where it's like, if you have a past attempt, you're at risk of another attempt. And then there's also research that shows if you have a past attempt and you survive, you kind of don't want to die. And so I'm the second part of that, where after I'd attempted, I just kind of was like, at first it was kind of self-deprecating, where I'm like, fuck, can't even like kill myself, right? You know, like having that humor approach. And then coming to the realization of like, well, no, like I actually do want to be here. So how do I make it so that I'm okay with being here? From there, it was just a lot of self-education. I didn't tell anybody. I ended up faking my crisis and kind of blaming it on substance use. So I ended up reaching out to a close friend, Chris Granier, who runs the Bomb Hole podcast, if anybody's heard it. He's really good at like showing up for people, like especially when it comes to like needing a daily check-in and accountability. So at that time I was kind of like, hey, like I need help getting sober. I need you to like help me out. And basically he just checked on me for like 3 weeks straight. And that was super helpful to have somebody kind of just like consistently hitting me up. And then after that, it was just like reading. It took a couple years to start talking about it is the thing though. So, I think too, like there's the reality of like snowboarding was like so hard for me and kind of traumatizing, but also it is a thing that does completely help you. You know, being in nature helps you, like having community helps. So I still had access to this like really vibrant community. And in a way it was just kind of like put my head down and walk through it. It's not going to be easy. It was super slow and heavy for a while. And then I kind of like, I don't know, it just got to a point where I was like, all right, I'm past that, which is also a contradiction because, you know, I still live with immense suicidality. Like there are days where I want to die. I don't have a plan and I don't have intent, but existing is really hard. So like, that's another important thing that, the nonprofit does is, we kind of like normalize the conversation surrounding like you can have suicidality, you can live with suicidality and not kill yourself. You can have a job, you can be a professional athlete, like you can be a doctor, you can be a person in society and want to die. And so that's even where I'm at now, where I still have like suicidal ideation and sometimes it's really hard, you know, like there's other diagnoses too that kind of go with suicidality. You know, it's like I have major depressive disorder. I have complex PTSD. Like existing has been hard. And so in a way, ideating about the suicide has always been something that like at least I'm in control of. And I think at the end of the day, like people just don't really want to hurt. People want pain to stop. And so getting past the suicide attempt was super painful, but also I think because of my lived experience, like I have a unique form of resiliency, and a ton of self-motivation. So also because of trauma, all I do is do a bunch of projects. And I think once the nonprofit like idea was planted in my mind, I was able to like latch on to that and be like, I can work, like my suffering can have a purpose. Like my pain and trauma can have a purpose. And then once I had more purpose, it's easier to live.
That's awesome. I think I have, you know, kind of a quick follow up on the, was the sobriety piece a cop out, or did you actually need to get sober at that time? And two, like within snowboarding, partying is kind of part of the lifestyle, right? Like you shred and you do your thing and you're drinking beers, you're partying. It's kind of that rock star, go hard lifestyle. Is it hard to maintain sobriety later on? So I guess it's kind of a two part question.
Yeah. For the record, I'm not sober currently. At that point in time, yes, I needed to get sober. One in four suicides is linked with substance use. And then, yeah, you look at action sports culture and how celebrated it is to use substances. People are sponsored by alcohol companies. Also, just the culture of partying. You're weird if you don't. Also, how are you supposed to network? How are you supposed to meet people if you can't hang out and, you know, kind of get on the same program? Where do you belong? So I think there's like a ton of people in our community who are sober, and like mad respect to them. And I think it's been better for them. Like I haven't landed there yet, but also I don't really foresee alcohol being in my future forever because there's a lot wrong with it. And, you know, like there's conversations about, you know, big alcohol being similar to big tobacco. You know, I think once we have more solid research about the health complications, like it's going to make more sense for people to choose a sober lifestyle. And then, you know, as far as the action sports things go, I do think we've seen a shift. I think I hang out with a lot of the youth, like 19 to 24 year olds. They're not really partying. They're high as hell. They love weed. But like for the most part, they're not drinking like the way that my generation was drinking. And so there's a ton of conversations to be said around substance use in action sports. But I think a lot of people are scared to have those conversations because there's also money involved and politics involved. Another side piece, Stay partners with the recovery center in LA called Restore. You can find the information on the website. We are offering scholarships for free recovery treatment, which is quite expensive. All you have to do is get yourself there. They donate 4 beds a year. So you just got to apply, send in a paragraph. You can start recovery for free.
That's awesome.
I've also read a little bit about you talking about this persona, I guess, that action sports athletes almost have to have, of being stoked all the time, being happy all the time, and the pressure that builds, especially when you're not. And it seems to really feed into the substance use or abuse issues as well. Can you speak a little bit about that? And then maybe like how social media just compounds that even more?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I think in the space, we are kind of required to be stoked. And if you're bummed out all the time, people aren't really going to want to hang out with you. One of the nuances of snowboarding is like, you can't really do it by yourself. You kind of need people to have your back. You need to have brands that want to support you. You have to have, you have to be accepted, you know, like no matter how much we want to pretend that like snowboarding is super like inclusive, it's not. It's super exclusive. It's pretty hard to break into like the inner circles. And I've seen a lot of people struggle with it just because of their personalities or because of their work ethic or because of their biases, you know? So there's, even before the substance use, there's so many requirements that go into how you're supposed to be and how you're supposed to present that it's pretty hard. It's difficult, and it can take a toll on your mental health, because what happens when you're not stoked? What happens when you're not accepted? What happens when you get injured? What happens when, you know, life occurs? And it's just, you have to censor and filter yourself. And that's kind of what we see on social media. We see a very fake representation of what life actually looks like. And I think it does such a disservice to everybody, because, you know, we do have the research now on what social media is doing to us as far as comparisons, depression, FOMO, and general, just like yearning for like a glorified life. But what people don't realize is they're looking at something that doesn't actually exist. And also, it's not a transparent interaction. Like, we get compensated to present a certain way on social media. all influencers do. And some people get paid in product, but for the most part, you're paid to give off an image. And that's not real. It's not real life. So from that, like, let's even like acknowledge what substance use is. It's self-medicating, you know, like it's fun, it's partying, but it's also a way to numb out. It's a way to like manage feelings and emotions because it's a depressant. And then from that, it's kind of like the funny thing about substances is that they work until they don't, you know? And so some people use substances and will never have a problem because they have a healthy relationship with it. But then there's others who use it to simply cope with existing. And I think, you know, that's kind of a funny thing to even acknowledge because people don't even realize that when they use it to fit in, that is using it to cope. So it's just kind of like getting people to begin to identify why they're choosing to use substances. And then at what point does it get out of hand?
I'm curious your thoughts. We're seeing a lot in the mainstream sports on concussion awareness and head trauma awareness and the role in mental health. Obviously in action sports, there aren't those strict protocols. If you get a concussion, you're not shut down, you know, and a lot of these athletes are self-employed and let alone helmets are obviously smart, but not always cool. What are your thoughts? Have you seen any correlation between repeated head trauma and mental health struggles?
Yeah, there's a ton of research out actually that TBIs are directly connected with suicidality and mental health issues. Additionally, a small concussion is considered a traumatic brain injury. I think a lot of people don't understand that. So I think we've seen a shift in the culture where helmets are cooler. Like Save a Brain exists, another local nonprofit that really just advocates for TBI awareness and wearing a helmet. And then there's the reality that it's still not the norm here. And I look at how when you're pro, when you're filming, when you're doing your job and you get a concussion, you know, a concussion isn't really as similar to like a blown out knee. Sometimes people don't necessarily take the appropriate steps to get the help that they need. And that can be super damaging down the line. So yeah, you're right. There is no like immediate protocol. There's no, you know, in action sports, like it's such like an independent thing where people just do whatever they can. Plus for the most part, people don't have health insurance. You know, our sponsors don't give us benefits. We're independent contractors. So if you get a concussion and like, you know, it's something that like, I feel like parents used to say where it's like, if you're not bleeding, you're fine. And I think that's scary. But at the end of the day, like people are going to do what they want to do. The only thing we can really keep doing is just spreading the awareness and, you know, educating the athletes or the team managers on like, yo, when you hit your head, you go to the hospital. There's no chilling. You go to the hospital and you get a brain scan because you can die. And I think, you know, people are still scared of that.
I think too, the recovery can be so complicated from traumatic brain injuries, and they're still trying to figure out what that recovery looks like and how it's different, you know, with each individual and each injury. And often people come back too soon, and a recurring injury can almost be that much more traumatic. And so educating obviously about prevention, but then also really educating about the time that it takes to rehabilitate an injury like that is critical.
Yeah, because what they know too is that TBIs compound. So the more that you get, the worse it becomes. And, you know, at the end of the day, we still don't know very much about the brain. I think there's a lot of, you know, just kind of like, yeah, maybe this is how it works. But to, you know, like we can get existential and be like, oh my God, there's this like blob within our skull that functions, that controls every single function that we experience throughout our entire lifetime. We don't even understand how memory works, you know? So the symptoms that people see after a TBI, it's like, I feel like they're just kind of winging it still in like rehabbing that. And it's truly scary because also when you do get a TBI and you lose like access to the thing that you're super passionate about or gives you purpose or gives you whatever physical exercise, like what does that life adjustment look like? Like there's so much loss there. And I think, you know, there is hope for recovery, but it is so much more complex than what people think.
Yeah. I mean, we talk all the time about ignoring injuries on this podcast because I think we're all probably guilty of that. That is not an injury that should be ignored at all. And I think because they often call it, you know, the silent injury, people may be more prone to do it because, like you said, there's no blood, there's no like outward presentation of that injury. And so it makes it that much more dangerous. I'm curious, like you've mentioned a little bit about your art, and I think this it's this really amazing combination of your emphasis on mental health and then also emphasis on art. And can you talk kind of about those independently, but also how they come together?
Yeah. Okay, wait, repeat that. So mental health and art, how they exist separately and how they come together.
Yeah, you got your bachelor's degrees from Portland State University in social science and art practices. And I've also seen some of the amazing like work you've done for Salomon, snowboards you designed. And it's more than just graphics, right? So I think hearing about you as an artist, but then also where art shows up for you in terms of mental health.
Okay, I love that. The art thing. So, you know, art makes existence truly beautiful. It's also so versatile and simple or complex. And, you know, I think from a pretty young age, I lived in a, you know, fantasy land in my head. And, you know, since a pretty young age, like I was kind of like creating narratives and trying to figure out how to find the language or find the way to get them out of my head, either onto a paper or into a poem or into some sort of self-expression, because in a way I felt like, oh my God, I'm just like super misunderstood kind of, or also like, I wish someone else could see this the way that I see it. So there's that conceptual piece. And with like conceptualization, I kind of realized like, I need to know more about how the world works in order to start creating these narratives that may, you know, I know that they resonate with me, but I also want them to resonate with other people. And I also truly believe that, you know, there's a ton of pain. So like, how do you share hope, or how do you share, relatability? How do you share, you know, in a way where it doesn't have to be my own personal experience? It can be something that somebody else can look at and be like, damn, like that makes sense, or that's helpful, or wow, that hurts. So that was always the allure with art for me. And as I began like working with brands, I had this unique opportunity to where I would see what other artists make, and especially like art and action sports, you're kind of like, it's so dude bro, or it's like metal, or it's kind of just like, or whatever, being somebody who's not male, kind of like all of the graphics I had to deal with as I was on the come up is like butterflies and vibrant colors, pink, and just kind of crap where I was like, I don't even like this. And if I don't like it, I'm assuming that there's probably a lot of people in this targeted demographic that might not like it either. And then there was like the industry norm of like shrink it and pink it. That's how we make women's product. And you know, that for me, like I didn't have an outerwear sponsor for 5 years because I refused to wear women's outerwear. It doesn't fit me and it's not what I want to look like. So having that lived experience when I started working closely with brands and being able to have this like signature product, or even just making product for the companies because I wanted it to look different, being able to take like that lived experience where I'm like, no, we're going to make something that maybe has an internal message, and it's not going to be such a strict message that people won't be able to do what they want with it, but it's going to be intentional. It's going to talk about connection, or it's going to talk about heartache, or it's going to talk about politics, you know, like I've had graphics shut down before because they're too feminist. And I'm like, cool. Thank you. That means I'm doing something right. But yeah, just immense intentionality with the artistic expression of making things that actually mean something. And I know there's a lot of artists, like, this is the thing too. Like, I'm not trying to yuck anybody's yum. Like, people can make stuff just because it's pretty. And my approach is just, I want to make something that says something. Because I also think people aren't really like saying enough. So that connection with mental health, this was, you know, kind of the beginning of being like, how do I talk about this really hard thing that there's a stigma against? How do I highlight depression? That way someone can see something, and then all of a sudden it kind of gets normalized to talk about depression. Or, you know, we look at the nonprofit, how do you look at a piece of art? And that literally normalizes talking about suicide, which is completely abnormal. And then even from that, when you make something like that and someone, you know, buys it or wears it, all of a sudden somebody knows that you're a safe space to talk about these things. So how beautiful is that? And why wouldn't you do that? So for me, it was a no-brainer to connect the two.
And you use art also, you mentioned in kind of the merch and how Stay shows up. So it's this kind of fluid interaction of the two, which I think is great.
Yeah. Also, like, we can look at history. Like, it's pretty apparent. People like art. It's one of the most celebrated things in our culture. So it makes sense to use it.
I was looking up some of the work you did with Solomon, the abstract, your pro model board. It's gorgeous. Like, it's such an incredible, like, piece of art, both from like a graphics standpoint, but also from a performance standpoint. I'm curious, when you sit down to design the board, is it like a canvas and you come up with this painting, or what is the medium? And then you go to Solomon and like, let's turn this into a snowboard. What's that? How do you go from art to snowboard?
Great question. My process is I start with words. So I like consider myself a pretty, like, solid ideator, where one of my skill sets is that somebody can want to do something and they don't really have the words for it, and they don't know how to take it out of the head and make it real. In a way, I almost specialized in that practice based on play techniques, word play techniques. So I start with a mind map. A mind map is just like a word. You build off the next word, you build off the next word. So anytime anybody's making anything, there's usually a reason why they're making it, you know? So the abstract was a super cool opportunity because I actually named that board and I created that board fully, where they combined two molds, the villain and the gypsy, to create the abstract. I had the opportunity of naming it. And so it's like, when you're looking at that graphic, there's the idea of like, okay, we were able to name it the abstract, which is pretty safe for the targeted demographics. It's a unisex board. You don't want it to be too gendered. You want it to be relatable. It's an art-based thing. Everybody likes art. And then as we continued to like work with it, I was kind of like, okay, so we're intentionally being abstract. We're intentionally, like, basically, like, we're creating this thing, quote unquote, with intention. And then during the time when it was being made, you know, I think it was kind of like that COVID time, also post Me Too, post George Floyd movement. There was still, and then there's like the industry was trying to like diversify and be inclusive, you know? And so for me, like, also, I'm white. I'm a white artist, you know, like, but looking at graphics and all of a sudden seeing the lack of representation in graphics and kind of like, oh, you're making this for a white audience, or you're making this for a straight white male audience. And so for me, like, I just like was like, I don't want to do that. So how do I combat that? And it's like, cool, you combat that with abstraction. You also combat it with connection and community. You also like just make it so that it's not isolating. And like from that, it's just like all those words on a piece of paper. And then I'm like, okay, cool. So what does that look like? And I'm like, cool, that looks like color variety. That looks like, you know, you look at the history of quote unquote abstract art. What do those marks look like? What does, what's like the conceptual approach to like being abstract? And then that board ended up being a little bit more literal than abstract, but really just playing with the idea of making it unreal or surreal. And, you know, just like getting all those words down and like being able to be like, okay, I want it to have a community thing. That means people are going to be tied together, which means there's going to be more than one figure, which means all of these things. And then from there, I'll just make thumbnails. And basically, I think I made like 7 thumbnails for this. And these are like, you look at them and you're like, are these scribbles? Like, what is this? Like each thumbnail maybe takes like 40 seconds. Send those to Solomon. They pick the one they like the most. And then I just run with it.
I know you weren't targeting a straight white male, but as a straight white male, that board is fucking sweet.
Thank you so much.
And if I was a snowboarder, I'm a skier, sorry. But if I was a snowboarder, I'd rock the shit out of that board because it looks awesome. How'd it ride for you?
Oh, it's great.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's still on the market. Cool. Another cool thing with that is we intentionally, or for me, I'm no longer doing the art on it, but as it stopped being my pro model and kind of went into the general line, there were rules, you know? And so the rules were you cannot have a male graphic designer make it. You have to get somebody who does not identify as male to make the art on it. And it has to like remain true to the purpose of like being a way to actually include like folks who wouldn't have an opportunity within the Solomon brand. And they have stuck true to that so far, which I think is great. And you know, it's just like those like types of little battles to like combat the patriarchy in the space.
Like, I think it's awesome. And yeah, kudos to Solomon for knocking that out of the park. I know on the Solomon side for ski, Drew Peterson also does a lot of work with mental health awareness. So it seems like a pretty, a brand that is living its values and really empowering athletes to express themselves both, you know, on snow and off snow.
Yeah. Actually, one of our like super volunteers with the nonprofit works for Solomon Ski full time.
Cool.
And he's like at all of our events. And I'm like, this is incredible.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
You've talked about snowboarding. It feels like this kind of like dichotomy between like something that is therapeutic nature, the movement, and then also kind of the patriarchy, the pressure. Can you bring us down to your roots of snowboarding and how it started for you and talk us through kind of the evolution of you as a snowboarder?
It's funny to look at it because I'm like, how did I end up here? I'm from Riverside, California. There's no snow in Riverside, California. The closest resort is minimum hour and a half away. You need a car, like you need money, you need resources. My mom and dad took me snowboarding when I was 16. So I even had a late start for learning how to do it. Highly athletic. In high school, like varsity across the board, track, basketball, volleyball, I took sports really seriously. And then I went snowboarding. Also, prior to going snowboarding, I had been exposed to skateboarding and kind of like skate culture through seeing skate videos. Also, at the time when I was in high school, I was in a program called Media and the Arts, where I was exposed to Photoshop at a really young age. And they taught us how to make an email and how to make a logo and decide like what type of creation you want to do. Like I was doing cell by cell animation in this program. I was making music videos. Like it was truly an incredible program. And so all of those things combined, and then all of a sudden, I should talk about like when I was in high school, I felt like I barely fit in. Like I had friends, but friendships were really tough for me. I'll chalk it up to me just like kind of feeling too much and wanting profound, like deep connection. But when you're that age, you don't really do that. Or I just kind of learned that people don't really do that yet. And I just landed there a little bit earlier than some of my peers. And that's because of music and movies. You know, like I had crazy exposure to media from a very young age. And I mean, that even started with books. And so all of a sudden, like, I was thinking that the world was supposed to be a certain way, but when it came to connection, I wasn't receiving that. All of a sudden I go snowboarding and I meet people and I'm like, oh my God, you are my people. You guys are weird. You guys are down to like be, you know, almost crazy. Like you're down to like ideate something or hike a feature to do a trick and make it look a certain way. And why are you doing that? Because it feels good. So from having felt like an outsider my entire life, the first year I went snowboarding, ended up meeting friends through MySpace, ended up like dating a person who showed me all the snowboarding videos. And that just like snowballed so quick because I felt like I actually belonged here or there within that culture.
That's awesome. I mean, I think the underlying part of community in the ski and snowboard world is so empowering. And so like you nailed it. I found my people. But you live an hour and a half away from snow. How did you get good? Like you can feel like you want to be a part of it and feel alive, but like you are really good. So how did you get up there enough to, you know, put in your time and take the lumps to get better?
I dropped out of high school.
Okay.
I wouldn't have ended up where I was if I wouldn't have made that transition. I ended up having, I had a friend die in high school, and this person, meant a lot to me. And then there were complicated things that happened after they died. She died in, you know, a van that my mother had sold to her. We had also had a fight a week prior about a boy. You know, there was, when you're hit with death like that, when you're in high school in Southern California, people can be mean. So after she died, I was attacked pretty hard. I was also depressed. I was also confused. I also didn't know how to act. And, you know, I do think that like being a teenager in Southern California is a very different experience than being a teenager in a lot of places. We're exposed to a lot of things from a very young age as far as like sex, drugs, like alcohol goes. I like remember just like talking to my mom about it. And then talking to my mentor in the media, like the TA that was in the media and the arts program. And, you know, he kind of helped me figure out a plan out. And I had to get approval from like the school faculty. And I had to go to like counseling sessions where they drug tested me to make sure I wasn't, you know, making a bad choice. And then I got out of that system. And then I think it was my mentor who told me about this continuation program that they had designed for pregnant teens. And I enrolled in that and then did my senior year within like 4 months, I think. So ended up getting a diploma, but in order to get it, had to leave the system I was in because I couldn't stay in that environment. The bullying was way too intense. And I think too, like I had a pretty wild sense of confidence and knowing that snowboarding would work out. I just had to get there and do it. And I didn't know what that would look like, but like I had a car and like my parents were somewhat supportive at this time. They were pretty supportive at this time before they really realized what my life would then look like. It's just, I was in so much pain that I was like, yeah, I got to get out of here. So left and moved to Big Bear.
In some ways, like it can be a therapy. It can also be an escape from dealing with a lot of what you just described. Which was it at that point?
Both. Yeah, because it not only did it give me community or purpose and exercise and happiness, it gave me an out. And I think too, you know, I have no idea what my life would look like if I would have never left Riverside. It's just like it facilitated such a vibrant life for me, like as soon as I just jumped in and committed. So it was both. It was therapy and an escape. Because also I did not want to be where I was
And so, yeah, just making the choice to be like, yep, I'm out.
You talked about losing a close friend in high school. And I think, I mean, you're in grad school now, or you recently wrapped up, but the brain cannot comprehend loss, let alone of a peer at that point in your life. It's so profound and it's so intense that I think like the foundation of your world is literally rocked when somebody your age dies when you're that young.
Yeah, this is trauma. And, you know, we all know that trauma affects the brain. It affects pretty much everything about you. And like this too, wasn't the death of a peer. This was a death of a loved one. And I think too, at that age, you know, the only thing that teenagers and adolescents really care about is themselves and what people think of them. So it's such a messy time in life to go through big trauma. And when it does occur, it's pretty profound. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an intense experience. I lost a good friend at 19, and you literally just don't have the tools at that age to deal with it and to understand that somebody your own age could be gone.
Yeah. And I mean, this is the thing too. Our entire culture avoids talking about death. So we look at the way that we're educated about death. And sadly, at that age, and even at older ages, people are not educated in how to respond to grief, because grief is so complex. And, you know, one day you're fine and it just happens so fast. And truly, just because of the lack of education surrounding death, people are like just dropped into the middle of the ocean and like no life vest, just kind of like deal with it.
So I kind of want to go, leave high school, throw yourself deep into the snowboarding scene. Like Shannon was saying, it's an outlet and therapy at the same time. You start to carve out your own style as a snowboarder. How would you describe your style?
How would I describe my style now? I think that's almost like the wrong question, because when I was coming into the scene, I was celebrated because I had style. And the constant conversation was, oh, you don't ride like a girl. And, you know, I also embodied that because like, yeah, I don't fully identify as a girl. Haven't since I was 12. And with that, it's kind of like, it was cool to be in that culture because I could embody, you know, the mask side of me and the way I presented. And that was just super fun. But so my style was just like, quote unquote, good. Like, oh, Desiree, like she has good style. Like that's kind of how it worked, because all of a sudden I looked different than the other girls who were trying to be snowboarders at the time. And I just started doing events and all of a sudden people are like, oh, cool. Like here's some outerwear. Got sponsored my first year, got free product my first year. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I can get this stuff for free. And then, just like figuring out like the loopholes with getting passes and tickets and, you know, just being in the environment and also being me, like I'm a pretty big personality. Like me as a teenager, that was crazy. I was so annoying. And to also like, cool, no more parents, no more rules. Who do I get to be? So in a way, like, and this is a privileged statement, but I had a moment of like self-actualization where I'm like, how do I want people to perceive me? And who do I want to become? Like, what do I like? And yeah, so just like the style, the culture, the community and Big Bear too at the time, like for me, it was quote unquote, like right time, right place. You know, like if I had to come up right now, oh, I'd be screwed. Like the kids are so good. The tricks are wild now. But for me at the time, like I specialized in rail riding, you know, so like I'm considered like whatever, street snowboarder. I film video parts. I produce like movies. Like that's the side of the culture that I occupy, because I didn't have the funds to join USASA and compete in slopestyle. That's what I chose. That's the path I chose. And it worked because there was very few of us doing it, us as in non-men doing it. And so, yeah, that. I forgot what the question was.
I That was awesome. I was curious, you know, your style. I love it. I think it's, I was watching a bunch of your video parts and it's like, yeah, you rip and you have this cool kind of subdued, but nasty, like you rip. And it was fun to watch. I was just curious what words you would put to it.
Yeah, no, thank you. And it was like, all that was intentional too, because I remember when I was younger, I was so mad at the lack of like people who weren't dudes filming video parts. There wasn't very many. And then the ones who were, it was like hyper femme. It was sexualized, you know, but also like you can look at like Tara DeKeyes and like no one can still touch her. Like there's the Jana Mayans. There's, you know, like all of like runway films, Leanne Pelosi, like all the people who came prior to my generation. But then there was like, I remember seeing like Hadar and being like, oh, this is it. And Laura Hadar was kind of like the punk, I don't give a fuck. Like, I'm gonna like be gross and like still like a woman and look really sick on my board, basically. So Hadar was a huge inspiration for me. And then, yeah, just the ways there were weird gaps in the growth of whatever snowboarding on a timeline, if you're looking at it on a historical timeline. And there's a period between 2009 and 2016 where just the girl street video parts just kind of fucking stopped. And then like, I just kind of, they didn't stop. They just weren't at the level that I wanted them to be at. I always thought that it could be higher. It should be higher if we're getting paid to do this. I had immense drive when I was younger, and I kind of like really collaborated with my friend Jess Kamira in a way to where we both just had this mentality where we were like, fuck it. We are going to film the sickest video parts and they're going to be in dude, like guy videos. And no one is going to say shit about us, like kind of almost filming a video part. Like we had to, you know, really intentionally make that choice to be like, no, we are going for this and we're going to change what this currently looks like. And in a way, I think we did.
A lot of those like sick video parts are, you know, obviously around the cities and in private property. Have you ever gotten in trouble or like gone to jail?
Haven't actually gone to jail, but I got a ticketed arrest for trespassing. And then at the age time, I definitely slanderized a cop. And then also got a ticketed arrest for poaching Brighton and they tried to charge me with identity theft.
Oh, did you steal like a pocket of pass or
something? I used somebody else's pass and then I like ended up getting charged like $800 and they banned me for a year. And then I had like to write a letter to the judge and I'm just like, this is right when I was like coming to Utah, I was like 17.
Welcome.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, this sucks. You guys suck.
Identity theft.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Well, and I'm just like, cool, man. Great. What does this do for you? Like,
well,
just
the lefty
take the
made
pass.
Like $50 or something stupid. Yeah. They incentivize the lefties, but yeah, it's a stupid one that they enforce. I've been caught doing that more than once.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
it's
I feel
tough.
I mean, that brings up something I'm curious about. Like, talk about your move to Utah. Like, what was it, riding that brought you here? Was it school that brought you here? Were you immediately like, what is this culture beyond Brighton? Maybe overreacting. Like, I'm what year did you come and how did you feel when you arrived?
All right. The first year I came, it must have been 2008, maybe. Yeah, 2008 or 2009. At the time I was living in Gresham, Oregon, going to Mount Hood Community College. And I got a call from Hadar. She was like, we're going on a film trip. City got snow. I had been filming with people, but never like with an actual production company. And, I was like, it was like kind of close to Christmas break, but if I would have left, I would have like failed my classes and just kind of like made the choice where I'm like, well, dropping these classes, like definitely going to Utah. Got here, stayed with Hadar, filmed in the city, got clips. It was, you know, kind of my introduction to professional filming. And then also like had Hadar's ID, you know, I was definitely a minor and all of a sudden like we clip up, we're done filming, get out to the bars, like meet Mikey LeBlanc, like all of a sudden, you know, have access to this community to where I've managed to go from just being like the bear park rat to now almost a person where people are like, who are you? What are you doing? And the next thing you know, I get signed to Holden, you know, because of, you know, Hadar inviting me on this trip and me being in Utah and meeting these people. So that's one thing that is super apparent within snowboarding is that Utah has always had a really robust community for snowboarders and probably skiers too.
The counterculture piece, I think, is strong here.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And, since then it was really hard to not come to Utah because there'd be events or it would snow, you know, back in the day it used to snow way more here and filming here was pretty good. Plus it's really central. Like it's really easy to go from the Pacific Northwest to Utah to get to Minnesota and then go to Quebec. Like if you're doing that, you know, North American tour for filming in the streets and can't get over to Europe, like it makes sense. So I've been coming here pretty much every year since I was 17. And then moved here full time because of getting into Westminster, the grad school program. Prior to that, I had just been doing, you know, winters kind of traveling around and filming because I was filming then. You don't just stay in one place when you're filming. You got to chase the snow. And then I'd always do summers in Oregon and, you know, ride Mount Hood or work on the glacier, be affiliated with the camps, work at the camps. And that was kind of another ingredient for figuring out getting good, you know, pretty quick because I was snowboarding almost year round, between like, yeah, bouncing around, chasing snow and then ending up on the glacier.
And the Westminster program, were you looking for programs that fit the course of study you wanted to take, or was that something that was of interest because you were already here?
Oh my God. This is actually pretty funny. So even, I mean, talking about the idea of grad school, like I had just graduated undergrad. It took me, all right, timeline too. It took me 5 years to get my associate's degree. It took me an additional 7 years to get my undergrad degrees. At this point, I had just graduated from PSU. And that was such a drawn out experience because I would only go to school in the falls and summer because I was snowboarding. And then so founded the nonprofit. Do all this research, like all of a sudden I'm in a place where I'm a person in a position of power spreading this message and being this advocate. And then I'm like, I don't know much about this at all. So then like whatever, started consulting with people, like called a bunch of therapists. And, you know, even they reacted pretty funny where they're like, you don't have to be a therapist just to run a nonprofit. And I'm like, well, no, actually I do. So that was the motivation for being like, okay, I'm going to now transition into the field of mental health. And of course, didn't know anything about that. Started Googling things, reading a bunch of books, ended up, you know, reading a lot of Carl Rogers, you know, reading a lot of these things. The things that would start to shape my opinions, I guess. And then I was like, oh shit, I need to apply to grad school. So kind of took like a year to build that out, what that looked like. And literally looked at one program and one school and applied to one program and one school because I was like, you know what, if I don't get in, it's not meant to be. And this is also kind of like the crazy things with me where I'm like, if I don't get into the one that I think is like pretty good, like I'm just going to go do something else. Like, I'll go get like a welding degree. I wanted to do that. It was either like learn how to weld or become a therapist. And so knew about the program, actually had a friend who was in it, like called her, asked her about it. And then somehow got in. And this is like definitely the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
I'm curious. I mean, whether it be dropping out of high school, but figuring out how to finish through the teen mom program, the length of time it took you to get your associate's degree and your bachelor degree. Like, I've got Frank Sinatra, like, I'll do it my way in my head right now. And I love it, but it feels like there's this pull towards learning. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'm obsessed with learning. If I'm not in school, I'm still learning. And I think I had that realization of like when I was quite young that I really just like doing things and I like knowing things. I have a like never ending thirst for knowledge, and it stems from curiosity. It stems from also wanting to be able to exist like in a way that aligns with me. So learning why things are certain ways and then learning what are the loopholes, because this sucks. So let's like learn something and then do it different, or find a way to change whatever it is that's occurring that maybe you're not aligning with. And then also aligning with stuff and compounding on that, because how beautiful is it that we can just continue to like engage with the world in so many different ways. And that's the motivation. That's the interest. And then also it gives me so much purpose. I think people spend their whole lives looking for like quote unquote purpose. And, you know, a while back, I kind of just, and this was after the suicide attempt, I truly landed at the place where I'm like, existing kind of gives me purpose because there's so much out there. The world is insane. Like, what is this? And, you know, then like I get quite existential where I'm just like, oh my God, existing is like really crazy. And then, I don't know, you can read a book and be like, oh my God, that's beautiful. Or yeah, just, I love learning.
And the sad thing is that our society puts these guardrails on what learning looks like. And we know that people learn in different ways, and those guardrails can almost snuff that desire out. So it's cool to see that you did it in your own way, or are doing it in your own way.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I think it's because I'm super fortunate to where I didn't get crushed by the system. You know, like we have a plug and play system in our nation where, you know, like you go through like, okay, you're in preschool, then you're in kindergarten, then you're in elementary school, then you're in middle school, then you're in high school. And if you're not in college right after high school, like all the media glorifies, or like the workforce glorifies, because also ageism is such a thing in our culture, then, you know, what are you doing? You're kind of like not doing it right. And so for me, I definitely didn't do it quote unquote right, but I got to do it my way. So I didn't have to get locked into a career that I didn't want. Like I didn't have to get into immense student debt, you know, like I was able to structure and pursue my path in a way that made sense for me. And sadly, the majority of Americans do not have that opportunity. Like most people just will never even be able to experience higher education because of the barriers to access. So like, yeah, immense privilege. And also like, I'm like in a way grateful to where I think, you know, being exposed to the culture of snowboarding and having this, you know, odd sense of confidence, I was able to be like, yeah, no, I'm doing this the way that I want to do it. And that's it.
I feel that your journey through all of this, you know, being in the marginalized population, and you've lived life your own way, you've taken your lumps, you've got some scars, like that as a therapist is going to give you authenticity with your patients. It's going to give you such a breadth of knowledge where you can truly help people because you've been there. You've done it. You didn't just go through academia and you're like, I can quote this study. This is what we're doing. Blah, 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 blah. It's like, you're real. You've done it. You live it. So like, I think, again, just my own opinion, like I think for you and your future patients, it's awesome how you've gotten there because you can offer so much.
Yeah. Thank you. And it's interesting in the program, they kind of like, you know, we learn that you don't necessarily have to have the lived experiences of your clients in order to be a good therapist. But as I've like gone through practicum and kind of started filling this role as a therapist, which I had immense imposter syndrome becoming, I'm like, oh my God, like I can't even help myself. How am I going to help you? And so all of a sudden, like it turns out because of the lived experiences, for the most part, I can sit in a chair across from somebody, and like my superpower is that I can talk to them. And you know, like that's in a way it's beautiful because I don't have to like stress out super bad about rapport building. For me, I like more or less come into issues with like what theoretical approach am I actually leaning into, because I still have no idea, which will come with time and experience. And you know, it's so unique to, unique's the wrong word. It is just like truly an honor to be able to do this work, because it's, because I know what it feels like, basically. And like, I don't know if that's selfish. I don't know if that's a narrow scope, but for me, my therapist changed my life, you know, and having access to resources changed my life. And, you know, I had a lot of bad therapists before I found good therapists. And, you know, going back to the education piece, sadly, the reality is we have to learn how to have good mental health. And where do you learn that? You're not learning that in school. You're learning that with your therapist. So yeah, it's, for me, like, it's truly an honor to be able to sit down with a client and do that work.
How would you describe having good mental health?
That depends. I think, you know, it looks different for everybody. I think it's maybe, you know, like, good mental health is just kind of emotional regulation and resiliency and adaptability. It's the way, it could be a way to be able to experience hardship and tough stuff, and you're able to get through it. And so that's the thing too, where like, just because you're affected by something doesn't mean that you necessarily have bad mental health. But when you end up in distress and when things become, you know, an issue and you're able to identify that that's an issue, that's kind of when you're like, okay, I might need some help, because chances are, you don't know what to do.
What, I mean, now, I mean, are you, so you're currently doing your practicum at Westminster, correct?
I just finished my practicum.
You just finished.
And then tomorrow is my last assignment for the year. I'm wrapping up a summer elective.
Wow. What, yeah. What is next?
I get like 8 or 9 weeks off, and then I go into internship in third year.
And is the internship something that's self-directed, or is there like, I'm almost thinking like rotations in medical school where you have to do rotations. Can you talk to us what that looks like? And do you have in your mind, obviously stay is going to be involved, but I want to hear like what you foresee moving into.
Oh my gosh. So many things. Turns out I want to do it all and you can't. My internship is at the prison. I'm going to be working with men's substance use. I'm going to have individual clients. I'll be doing some groups. That's going to be a year-long event till I hit hours. I'll have supervision. And then, yeah, third year we'll wrap up. The nonprofit is so tough to do while in school. Oh, my God. I'm so grateful for my team. So right now I'm functioning as the executive director. I was on the board for a long time, but it turned out that that wasn't the best role that I could have because I was just doing the job of an executive director. So, as we move forward, we're kind of, especially as I go into internship, we kind of have to plan a little bit more mindfully. This year we ended up doing like 20 something events and I'm like, this is awesome. This is great. But also I am so burnt out. And also sometimes it's just really hard to look at suicide all the time. It's exhausting. And then, you know, like that might even sound weird me saying as like a therapist, but like, no, the reality is like even therapists need to take a break from exposure to mental health stuff. You know, like that's why we have routines to go through at the end of a day after working with clients or going through tough stuff. Like we need to be able to refill our cups. So as we go, I mean, the nonprofit, I have like a 10-year plan and I'm so hopeful about it because I do think it's actually working. And I think too, as we continue to make these like pretty powerful programs and continue to provide resources for free, like hopefully we're just going to be able to generate actual funding to keep doing the level of work that we're doing. And then for me, like honestly, like probably once I get full licensure, like I'll be able to be a professional within the space of the nonprofit. And then also, and that to me is like pretty important community work. But then the reality too is like, I'll still have to go through licensure hours. I'll have to align at, I'll have to apply to a job and work somewhere and then have another supervisor until I reach hours. And that's probably going to be like a 2-year process.
As you're juggling academia and internships and clinicals, what's your relationship with snowboarding looking like? Are you still getting out to ride?
This year I did not get out to ride very much. I can talk about kind of a weird thing actually that not a lot of people know about. Basically, I experienced actual PTSD in correlation to snowboarding. So this year I was having, you know, these symptoms that would present where I'd drive to go to Brighton, I would get to the parking lot, I would have a panic attack and then drive home. And it was very confusing. And also like identity shattering, because if I'm not Desiree, the pro snowboarder, then who am I? And if I can't even go and do the thing that I love to do, what is wrong with me? And so super grateful from, you know, pursuing this career choice because I actually knew what to do. And I've slowly been working through it. But the reality is something happened, and as something, I think it's last year I ended up producing a film called Bittersweet in partnership with Slush the magazine, and 2 days before the first trip broke my back. 9 weeks later, broke my tailbone. Like minor fracture on my ankle. 6 weeks later, broke my ribs. After that, and then this year, first day I go snowboarding, fracture my tailbone. So I'm sitting on like a mountain of medical debt, immense frustration with, you know, my body and pain. And then also just kind of like, well, how do I get back on the horse? What am I doing? So this year I went snowboarding much less than I ever have ever in my life. But also I kind of knew that that was going to be the case. And I communicated with my sponsors about that. I had support. They support this path and what I'm doing. And with the nonprofit, I'm still super forward facing within the community. Like even making the film last year was, you know, pretty impactful for like the people who were in it and for myself as whatever, a member of like the culture and like it, occupying this like professional space. But I think too, it's become a redefinition of how am I a professional snowboarder right now in 2025, as people publicly know that I'm transitioning into a different career. But then I also in the back of my mind have the questions of why can't I occupy this space? There are plenty of men in the industry who occupy roles like that. They're called legends, or they're called, you know, whatever, the people who shaped the culture. And so in my mind, I don't really feel bad being, you know, a quote unquote professional snowboarder still, because I get compensated to do that as a job, because I still do a lot in the professional space of it. But sadly, I did not snowboard very much this year.
I mean, that's a long list of injuries that you went through. So, I mean, the physical and mental toll that we do a couple episodes here and there on the rehabilitation process, but you listed off some pretty serious injuries. And so, you know, the physicality of bouncing back from that, as well as the mental toll that takes. So I can see why.
Well, and then the year before that, full MCL reconstruction surgery during my first year of grad school. Yeah. So it's, injuries are really tough.
And then when you're also transitioning into this career and figuring out, as you said, like where your identity falls between being a professional snowboarder, pursuing mental health counseling, and what your path is going to look like in terms of integrating both. And then your, you know, injury list, I can see that's a lot. It's a lot on your plate anyways, without those back-to-back injuries.
Yeah. And then, something else a lot of people don't talk about, financial stress.
Yeah.
You know, where I've had, you know, some peers be like, you should just drop out of this program. Like, you're not okay. Like, honestly, too, these 3 years have been probably the toughest 3 years of my life as far as emotional anguish goes and physical anguish. And so, you know, because of financial stress, too, I've taken out so many student loans that if I do not complete this program, I'm probably going to have to file for bankruptcy. Additionally, my only source of income is from the few sponsorships I still have. And, you know, with that too, like me going into grad school, of course, it only made sense for them to restructure my contracts and make about half than what I've been making for the last 10 years of my life. So going from like a stable income to a very tough spot financially, and still needing to like, or also transitioning too out of like a lifestyle that I became pretty accustomed to, and like having to make those adjustments as well. All of it was so much and kind of went crazy, but also didn't. Like, I'm here, I'm doing pretty good now.
You mentioned before the importance of therapists and the ability to refill their cup. Just kind of thinking about your, all the things on your table and all the people who rely on you is fairly intense and can, I would assume, drain you pretty intensely. How do you refill your cup and how do you kind of refresh?
Oh my gosh. One of my favorite things that has happened since I moved here full time, joined a volleyball league. So my reset is honestly volleyball. It has been amazing. Like, I played in junior college. I grew up playing indoor, playing here. It's just been sand, and it's, you get the cardio up, and it is just so so fun. Like, I actually feel like a kid. Also, the members who kind of play a lot here in sand, like, just so welcoming, like, so queer, so fun. And just never thought that I would have something like that again, where I'm like driving to the courts and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so excited to play. Like, I cannot wait to get on the court and play, because that for me was like snowboarding and skateboarding for so long. So that's what I do to refill my cup. Also, I started writing music, and that has been, you know, creatively so fulfilling, where it has always been on my to-do list my entire life. And somehow for the first time ever, it's aligned to where I'm surrounded by some like-minded people. And I'm also like being supported in this creative like form of expression. And that to me is such a cool like evolution, even as an artist. So like that just is, that is the one, like, I'm like, all I want to do all day is make music. I'm like, get me through this last class. Like, don't call me. I just want to write music. So that's been amazing. Other than that, yeah, hanging out with my dog, getting outside, went mountain biking for the first time 2 days ago. Terrifying. My favorite part is like people like the entire time, they're like, oh, it's just like snowboarding. It's just like snowboarding. Like, it's so sick. It's just like snowboarding. And like, I have some biking experience. Like, I did a couple like crazy bike rides or whatever, and just had never been on a mountain bike. And I'm up there and I'm like, all right, going up is cool. Like, I like going up because it's fulfilling. I don't know. I'm like, oh, can I make it? Like, this is great. Like, going up, get to the top. I had no business being on this trail. There were so many rocks. I was just like, I'm going to die. But actually, like, whatever, natural and like, yeah, the natural like athleticism kicks in, and I'm just like, all right, cool. Here we go. Like, don't go over the bars. Like, shinned myself a couple times, but for the most part, did fine. Might go again. It's scary.
Mountain biking is an acquired taste for sure. Not only are you fighting the fitness piece, but rocks hurt, branches hurt.
They're sharp.
Trees don't move.
They don't move. You're not wearing any pads. Typically, you're wearing shorts or tank top, and you're like, you're going to get cut. Yeah. It's not great.
I felt so exposed. When I snowboard, I wear butt pads, knee pads, shin guards. Like, I'm like, this is so dangerous.
I still think skateboarding's probably the most unforgiving of all.
Concrete hurts.
Yeah, it does.
I love skateboarding. It's great.
Awesome. I mean, this has been such an amazing conversation, Desiree. Like, I've learned so much. I feel like you've given our audience I want to learn more about Stay, and I'm sure they do too, like, such great resources, as well as a really great picture of someone that's overcome a ton and has found their own path in their own way. And that's really inspiring. We always like guests to kind of leave our audience with some words of wisdom or something that they've learned. Can you grant us that?
Sure. I mean, before that, thanks for having me. It's cool to share whatever about this kind of stuff. It helps. It serves the point sometimes. I think for listeners, a nugget of wisdom, honestly, don't kill yourself. It sucks. It's probably really hard. It probably hurts really bad. But I do truly think that it can get better. And the only way for it to get better is for you to try to make it better. It's not just going to magically get better. But killing yourself is not the solution. You know, there's other options. And, you know, when it does happen, like, all right, cool, that actually was the only solution. And I don't know, I just think that there's different ways to try that will eventually hurt less. It's just getting the right treatment and getting access to the right resources and tools and feeling less shame and guilt about feeling like that. So yeah, I'll just bring the wisdom just straight back to the suicide talk. Also, if anybody's hurting, once again, call or text 988, use Google. I don't know. That's my take.
Yeah, an important one. We have some gnarly products for you. I don't know if you've ever gotten to try gnarly nutrition stuff before, but you came into our podcast studio, and so you can pick and choose what you want, everything from hydration powders to protein. We also have some great Gnarstool merch and these wonderful tumblers from a company in Park City called Summit that Jason and I are both huge fans of. Stainless steel, the lid is magnetic and sticks on the bottom so you don't lose it. They're leak proof, and I think whether it's cold or hot, they've been a saver for me. One of my favorite receptacles to drink out of. But it really has been an amazing conversation and a huge pleasure to learn about your life and all the amazing, impactful ways that you are affecting others in a positive way. And we really appreciate you.
Thank you. I have one more plug, actually.
Yeah.
The nonprofit is also facilitating the creation of a cookbook.
Oh, rad.
It's called What to Eat When You Want to Die. I think that's how I became connected with y'all, through Aaron Butler. So we hired a nutritionist to actually write all the recipes. And it's, you know, a science-based approach to what you can put in your body when, you know, you're really struggling with suicidality or just having a hard time because eating's hard to do when you're sad.
Is that available now, or can you let us know when it's coming out?
That will come out, I'm assuming. Our goal is around the holidays. So yeah, fingers crossed for that. And if people align with that, it's going to be available for free. You'll be able to download the entire thing. And then hopefully we're also going to get some hard copies made that people can buy. And you know, that's us doing our part where we provide the free resources, but then try to find a way to still make some money. Also, if anybody is inspired by what the nonprofit does, please consider going to our website, somebodysthinkingaboutyou.org, and consider donating. It's so impacting when we get like the monthly donators or just anything, because truly, like, we are so small and we do so much and we have nowhere near enough money to do the work even that we're doing or, you know, what we want to do. So I'm just really appreciative for my team and their patience as we kind of work really hard to build out this incredible thing with not a lot of resources. People can also follow us on Instagram. Our Instagram handle is at Somebody's Thinking About You.
We'll link to Stay's website in our show notes. And then we always kind of put out a newsletter to the Gnarly Nutrition audience when these podcast episodes come out. And we'll also link there and prompt people to donate if they're able to, because really important cause.
I appreciate it. Did you ask me a question about the product and then I just went on a tangent about the cookbook?
No.
We'll let you kind of pick whatever you like. We've got some options back here. And I did want to echo what Shannon said. Thank you so much for being open and honest. It was such a real, raw conversation, and I feel like our audience and myself included took a lot from it. So I'm excited to see kind of how this continues to evolve and how you can help people and serve patients. And I'm a fan, so we'll be sitting back and watching what you do next.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks so much, Desiree.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Gnarstool Podcast.